Today's guest joined us from Australia. In this episode, we revisit relative energy deficiency in sport, and we offer considerations for coaches who work with athletes. This is the Bodywise Podcast.
Welcome, Jennifer. Our thanks goes to a previous podcast guest, Dr. Rachel Langbein, for suggesting that we have a conversation with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, it's great to be here. So my name is Jennifer Hamer, and I recently completed my PhD out here in Australia on the Gold Coast at Griffith University. And a lot of my research centered around supporting coaches to manage the risks of relative energy deficiency in sport alongside eating disorders as well. A lot of this stemmed from kind of that lived experience as an elite athlete whose career ended very early due to REDS. So that's kind of the acronym for relative energy deficiency. So definitely there's a real personal passion that was a drive for my PhD. And now kind of working in the mental health space, as well as staying across that sports arena in terms of trying to support our coaches and athletes' health and well-being.
As you say, we're having a conversation today about REDS and what coaches need to keep in mind. Before we explore this, what sort of factors and harmful practices in the sporting environment are contributing to the growing concerns for athlete health?
It's a really interesting question, because we know that our athletes definitely have predisposing intrinsic traits which will increase their risk of developing REDS. But what we've actually got now is a sporting culture which really has become so performance orientated that we've really let go of this idea that we've got to be nurturing athlete health basically before performance outcomes. I always go by the term that you can't have a performing athlete if you haven't got a healthy athlete, for sustainable terms anyway. In the short term, it might work. But in terms of practices, in a lot of our endurance and physique orientated sports, we've definitely got an overemphasis on physique monitoring, body image issues, and specifically language and behaviours that are being used to manage that or monitor that. And sometimes this is language which, without any ill intent, I'll provide an example. So a coach reinforcing to an athlete that they're looking super lean as a compliment to their athlete. But what can actually happen is that athlete internalises that message of, I need to maintain this particular physique to be performing. But we actually don't know how that athlete got to that stage. They could have got there through very unhealthy nutrition behaviours or extra training behaviours. They may even be experiencing disordered eating behaviours. So some of the language, or the majority of the times, things are being said without any ill intent. We do have situations where some coaches have been called out for deliberately using inappropriate behaviours with their athletes, whether that's around training or nutrition practices or encouraging poor dietary practices. And I think there's a bit of a confusion across the sporting world in terms of scope and responsibilities. And I guess my sort of real area was zooming in on the coach and realizing actually they've got such a complex role. And I think sometimes because they're being asked to be so many things, a life coach, a performing coach, a friend, a counselor, all of these different things, sometimes it's hard for a coach to know where they need to draw the line of what they're there to do. And so it's definitely that language and behaviour which has kind of shaped a sporting culture, which, yeah, has just led to some really poor health outcomes for our athletes.
There is a little bit sometimes you get the sense that, well, we need these people to be Navy SEALs, and that's not really what the objective should be at all.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. There is this kind of, you get this sense of this military. I always sort of see it as like military training. And I sometimes think we forget that first and foremost, our athletes are human beings. And it's very easy for coaches and athletes, when they're immersed in their sport, to be right there thinking about that immediate goal or that big success that they're striving for. And what they can often forget is looking at that bigger picture of what happens beyond. And an athlete really does deserve to pursue their sporting career and beyond their sporting career on a positive, healthy life journey. And so I think it's always remembering that we need to nurture not just now, but also for future. But one thing that I believe is really challenging in that scenario, especially for a coach, is when they are so emotionally invested in their athlete's performance, it can be incredibly challenging for them in that moment to always be thinking about those health-related aspects. By default, they are so focused on trying to help their athletes achieve their goals. But I think that's where we need, which I'm sure we're going to come to later on, a lot more intervention, prevention, and education awareness sort of space.
Is there literature on that, the emotional investment?
There is some in terms of attachment styles of coaches and the kind of relationships that athletes can build with their coaches. I would have to go back into the literature because I know I referenced this into my PhD. But there was kind of these ideas of avoidant relationships where coaches could avoid seeing the problems that were presented for them and kind of brushed them under the surface. And then there were confrontational relationships between the athlete and coach where there would be a lot of confrontation and challenging from the athlete and the coach. And I can't remember the last one, but I'll have to jump back into the literature and get that one for you.
Last year, 2023, saw some further development related to REDS. So the scientific knowledge grew further, such as the International Olympic Committee's latest consensus statement.
Yeah.
That's very valuable again, because it has the latest infographics. It's not just one paper. It's many multiple papers that have come out of that as well.
Yeah, there was such a development for the 2023 consensus statement, and a lot of us were just so excited for when this was going to be released, and there were some fantastic collaborators and authors on those papers. I think some of the key things that were really presented in that statement were some of the kind of more recent sort of emerging evidence that we're finding around REDS. So one of the big ones was around this idea of low carbohydrate availability being one of the key drivers actually contributing to REDS. There was a fantastic paper by Nikita Fenchman, which came out, I believe, 2022. And that was actually a paper where they identified that low carbohydrate availability had a greater impact on bone resorption compared to just low energy availability itself. And so there was this real sort of really interesting finding that was actually sparked a real interest in going to explore this impact of low carbohydrate availability. So that's a really topical area which is emerging in that latest REDS consensus statement. We also had that expansion around REDS in our male athletes. And then this idea of adaptable and problematic low energy availability. So I'm not sure I'm sure you have seen the updated REDS model. We now have these arrows going out from the middle, which span out to the outer layers and basically kind of identifying that our elite athletes at periods of time will be exposed to low energy availability. And in short bursts, it can be adaptable and okay, but once we start seeing those repeated bouts or those long periods is when we start to see the problematic issues occur and that development of REDS. Yeah, and then I think we had a few additions to the wheels. So we had the addition of sleep disturbances, urinary incontinence, and this association of the mental health issues that are either preceding or as a consequence of REDS. So, and then we had the clinical assessment tool, which was produced. We had so many different papers which were released around. We had managing physique issues. So I think what I really hope, though, is that, and this was the whole basis of my PhD, was really taking that research and actually going and putting it on the ground. And I really hope we actually start to see that translation of this work, because everything that's been published is so valuable, but it needs to be fed down to our athletes and coaches. Otherwise, it's sat on the journal, which is fantastic. But sadly, the people that read that tend to be those who have a bias into the area rather than the people that we actually really need to know about this stuff.
Can you bring us through the studies you conducted, which focus on coach interventions?
Yeah, I would love to. So as I said, my PhD was all, it's titled Supporting Coaches to Manage the Risks of REDS. And it was a very practical applied PhD. So my first study was really to gain an understanding of the landscape. So we wanted to understand what education was being provided to coaches on this issue across Australia. And we specifically looked at endurance-based sports for this study. So we chose five of the big endurance-based sporting organisations. So we had Cycling Australia, Athletics Australia, Triathlon, Swimming and Rowing. And I conducted interviews with those five sporting organisations to get an understanding of what education was being delivered to coaches on this issue or areas that are closely aligned with REDS. And what we identified was that four out of the five organisations were delivering no education at all in this space. The one that was, which was Rowing, had somebody across the coaching education department who was very interested in this area. So they actually incorporated it based on that kind of personal bias. And when we actually explored some of the barriers for organisations to incorporate this, we had things like time as and resources as one of the barriers. But one of the ones that really stood out was coaches' pre-existing attitudes, beliefs and behaviours towards this issue, as well as the variability in knowledge across coaches. And this was identified as one of the barriers of why organisations weren't including education across this space, as it would become very challenging for them when they've got such a variability in terms of knowledge, behaviours, attitudes and beliefs. So we kind of pulled that barrier and said, we really want to go and explore and what we know about that, because no one had really actually gone into the literature and actually looked at, well, what do coaches know? How are they behaving? What's their attitudes and their beliefs? So that kind of directly fed into my second study, which was a review looking at exactly that. So coaches' knowledge, attitudes, beliefs and behaviours towards low energy availability in REDS. And we also incorporated disordered eating and eating disorders there because it was really important we didn't miss any literature that might overlap, as those conditions we know can closely align. And what came out was that we had very limited literature in this space. A lot of what had been conducted was very much on the female athlete triad, so our previous kind of understanding of low energy availability. And the tools that had been used were, there was just no consistency. There was no consistent tool being used across studies. So there was a lot of heterogeneity across the studies. And there was no kind of in-depth understanding. A lot of these were kind of survey tick boxes. Can you recognize the three components that form the female athlete triad? And so we can understand a coach's ability to recognize three components of a triad doesn't really translate into a comprehensive knowledge of what they need to do if they're managing that issue in sport. But what we were able to take from that study was that there were inappropriate behaviours happening in terms of inappropriate language around body image, physique, nutrition practices, and these were also translating into behaviours. And that was evident from that review. So at that point, I was then really fortunate to collaborate with Swimming Australia on a practical initiative where we wanted to build an educational intervention for coaches to support them in managing REDS within their daily training environment, specifically looking at language and behaviours that they're using. And this was a really big study that we worked on, and we did it in a really thorough, comprehensive way. We outsourced to a research and development specialist. We didn't want to build something which was a lecture-like education session where we just delivered information to coaches and expected them to go out and change. What we really wanted to do was to build something which was practical, hands-on, applied, really relevant to their coaching environment so that they felt equipped with the capabilities to know what to do. So we interviewed swimmers. We interviewed the swimmers who came back from the Tokyo Olympics. We got an understanding of their thoughts and feelings about behaviours and language that was being used within their coaching environment and what they wanted more of, what they wanted less of. We interviewed coaches to get a gauge of their understanding and experience. We interviewed coach leadership teams, education teams. We really wanted to understand the Swimming Australia system before we began to build anything. And then we looked at a scoping and consultation phase. So we looked at what was the problem within swimming And when we did this, we actually identified over 100 problems. And when we then narrowed those all down, what we came up with was some of these that we identified as problems were actually consequences of a problem. And some of them were causes of a problem. So we started to create these like problem trees. And eventually we came with a very broad, concise, but spot on statement that was swimmers are potentially in a harmful training environment that can lead to short or long term negative health implications. I'm pretty sure that was wording. And from there, we built our workshop. So we had key learning objectives for 5 sessions within a 5-hour workshop that we were going to deliver. We built scenario case study activities for coaches to work through. The workshop actually ended up being 80% practical, 20% theory. So we delivered minimal theory on this. It was really around helping coaches. They needed to know what it was, why it's a problem. But really importantly, we wanted them to know, how do you mitigate risk? What do you do? How do you identify someone who might be at risk? What do you do when you identify someone at risk? And how do you build those support networks and stay connected? And so it's really around equipping coaches with that. And we used a model of behaviour change to assess our impact. So we used what's called the COMBI model. And this is basically a model which is a proxy for behaviour change. So we looked at capabilities of coaches, opportunity and motivation to implement new learnings into practice. And we did a follow-up 6 weeks after the workshop. We followed up with them to see whether we could find any indications of changes to how they were practicing in their daily training environment. And interestingly, we had some really positive results, which would have suggested we were having some positive changes in the swimmers' environment. We had coaches who were incredibly motivated to go back and implement some of these learnings. They were so enthusiastic about what they were learning. We had a group of coaches that had increases in their psychological capability. So mentally they were prepared, they knew about the condition, they knew what they were expected to look out for, they knew what was expected of them to mitigate risk. But the downfall was their physical capability. So actually going and doing it, they didn't have the confidence to go back and implement. And so this for us was not a huge surprise for me, because there was this element of fear from some coaches, fearful of going back and potentially saying the wrong thing, or fearful of going back and it isn't what their head coach wants to do. So they might be told that they can't implement this. So there was this sort of power dynamics in the environment. For me, it was more a case of, well, we need repeated exposure of this education. It's such a complex area. It's a sensitive area. And coaches really need supporting with kind of that ongoing repeated exposure, as well as us targeting from kind of like a top down. So we're really changing the culture of an environment so that they then feel confident to implement. So that work was a huge project, and we're kind of still building on some of that work with swimming to see if we can start scaling it across some other sports here in Australia. Just I'm trying to find out for some funding at the moment, as we are always doing in sport. But yeah, that was kind of a big summary of my PhD.
I'd imagine some of the coaches probably maybe swam themselves, would they, or have had a background?
Yeah, I believe we did have a few coaches. So our initial workshop that we ran, we had 32 coaches in the room. Most of them had come from their clubs in groups. So we actually kept them with their clubs on the tables where we had them sat in the workshop. And that was specifically because we appreciated that every environment might be slightly different. And we really wanted them to be able to personalise this to their club environment. And we did have some swimmers who were reflective of their journey, and that I feel that they actually were a little bit more empathetic to what we were speaking to, because I think they could, looking back, realise that actually they were kind of exposed to some of this stuff and how it wasn't helpful for them when they were receiving language that wasn't so beneficial. We had a couple of coaches put their hands up and say, I think I might have reds when we're in the middle of the workshop, because they've just learned about something they'd never heard of. And then we did have some issues where we had some more kind of old school coaches compared to our kind of younger coaches coming through, and you saw differences in the resistance to what we were trying to get them to do. So kind of we had a couple of coaches who were, this is what I've always done, this is how I coach, I'm not changing now. Whereas we had some of our more kind of young emerging coaches who just wanted to take everything. They really wanted to go and do the right thing and really be that role model for their athletes. So that was also something which was quite interesting to observe.
Do you have suggestions for future research and what materials were developed through your work?
Yeah, so I think future research in this space, I definitely believe we need to move away from interventions which are assessing knowledge in this space, just knowledge. I don't think that is helpful. And the reason I say that is because knowledge is not a strong predictor of behavior. A simple explanation, if you think of the general population, if you ask the general population their knowledge of understanding that fruits and vegetables are good for them, they will say yes. But does that always translate into the general population meeting the requirements for fruit and vegetable intake? Well, our data would suggest not. And it's the same when we look at something in the space of REDS. We can have knowledge about condition, but that doesn't equip our coaches with the capability to behave and employ the appropriate language in the coaching environment. And so what I mean by interventions need to stop just measuring knowledge, it's not showing us what's happening on the ground. Yes, it's great if you increase a coach's knowledge, but what does that translate into for our athletes? And so what I think is really important is when we are thinking about designing future interventions, thinking from that applied lens. So always thinking, how is this applicable to the coach and the athlete when they're actually in practice on the ground? And so then all of a sudden it becomes more contextual learning, it becomes more scenario-based learning, and it becomes customized to an athlete's and coach environment. And I think that really is the way forwards for us if we're going to actually see a sustainable change in our kind of sporting culture that's going to lead to protection of our athlete health and well-being. So that's something I think is really important. I also think, and this was kind of my hope for post-PhD, it didn't quite materialise, but I believe that we need research that is longitudinal. So we followed up 6 weeks post-workshop. But what I would actually really like to do now is to deliver a workshop, follow up 6 weeks, deliver another workshop, and then follow up, say, a couple of months later, and then maybe another one and another follow-up, and see over time whether we can actually start seeing whether there is some real positive change over a longer period of time with this kind of repeated exposure. Because we had 6 weeks, which we did get feedback, which is some coaches said they didn't feel like they'd had the time to implement things. And we actually don't know what happens long term then, whether that information gets lost and they're back to their old ways. So I think with behaviour change, we know it's something which takes such a long time. And so we need that kind of ongoing monitoring for that. So I think those two things for me are the real key things for anyone who's going to go into kind of this area for their research.
Do coaches ever say if they have to talk to an athlete's family or anything like that? Or is there any literature on families and REDS where they may have a son or a daughter who's an athlete, do you know?
So I can't say I've delved into that area of literature because I guess I've been so immersed in that coach arena. It's a very important point you raise though. And when we actually developed our workshop, we developed a booklet of coach resources that went alongside the workshop. And the whole idea of these resources was for them to be usable. So not just that a coach could pick them up and understand the information, but they could actually pick them up and understand it and then take it into their practice. So again, it was really this idea of applied approach. But what we actually did with this booklet was we had icons in the corner of every page. And the icons represented a coach, a parent or carer, or a swimmer. And so the idea, the information in these booklets, every bit of information or every page or every kind of little infographic that was included would have the icons next to it to show who that bit of information was really aimed at. And it wasn't to say to them, don't read the other bits, but it was basically saying, like, this is really important for you and we really need you to know about this. And we did that on the basis of knowing that whilst we delivered a workshop for coaches, this would also then be scaled across to parents, to swimmers with adaptations, but we would already have our resources built, which would then go alongside another workshop. So it was done in such, and that's why I mentioned how we outsourced to this research and development specialist. So we were equipped with these skills to know actually how do you build an intervention that's not only scalable in size, but scalable in terms of population groups so that you don't have to go back to the drawing board to build again. Parents and carers are critical in this piece of the puzzle as well. And I think it's a real challenge for the coach because they can obviously control what they can control in their environment, but what goes on at home, they can't really control. So again, I think we can't get it out quick enough, I guess, but it is a case of we need to get that education there out for our parents as well. And I guess if there's any budding PhD candidates out there who want to tackle the parents and carers, go for it, because the more we can get out for the key stakeholders, I think the better.
For coaches who may be listening, what do they need to know to work effectively to support athletes and ultimately reduce and prevent REDS?
I think first and foremost, it's becoming familiar with what REDS is and understanding why this is such a problem. I think when we delivered our workshop, the coaches were incredibly shocked to hear of what the implications could look like for an athlete from underfueling. And as an athlete who had first-hand experience of her career ending from osteoporosis at 22, it's really that serious, and I'm one of many. I think sharing that with the coaches was really important. And we actually created a video of how did we get here, which took coaches through a timeline of how we've actually ended up in this space. And it really did share some quite horrifying stories of athletes who were broken so young and never even got close to reaching their potential, whatever their potential might have been. But what we want coaches to know is no one's to blame for this. The coach isn't to blame, the athlete's not to blame, the parent, carer's not to blame. But what we all have is a role to now be the solution. And so I think for coaches out there, it's first and foremost becoming very familiar what REDS is. You don't need to know kind of medically a lot of the kind of terms, but you just got to have a broad understanding of how the condition develops. So underfueling, not consuming enough food for what they're expending, over prolonged or repeated acute bouts of time, leading to those implications that develop as we know as REDS. And so in terms of the next steps for them, it's knowing what the signs and symptoms are in their athletes. So being aware of what are they potentially looking out for in athletes who may have REDS could be changes to their training outcomes, their performance outcomes. They might not be hitting times. They might be getting injured more frequently. They might be getting unwell more frequently. Even things sometimes like isolating themselves from the training group. If coaches are present when food's being taken, whether their nutrition habits seem to have changed. We have even subtle ones that we identified with some of the athletes where athletes were on pool deck and they'd subbed out a normal Powerade for a sugar-free Powerade. And they had like a 2.5 hour set in the pool. They needed the full Powerade, but this was kind of like an indicator that there was a change. So there are many things. There are just a few that I've listed, but the signs and symptoms are readily available if they want to go and look them up in terms of what they're looking out to identify. In terms of managing risk, it's avoiding commentary on an athlete's body. There's no need to be commenting. I think if a coach is working in a sport where physique is being monitored in a holistic and healthy way, because it may be needed to in terms of a weight category sport, if a coach is concerned on any level, it's speaking to the sports dietitian who's within that org or speaking to more senior staff within the org. It's not going to the athlete and saying that they're concerned that they're not lean enough. It's just a no-go because we don't know where that can go. And similarly with the nutrition, it's simple nutritional messaging, so encouraging fueling. So an example being, we've got a tough session this afternoon. Remember to make sure you have a good substantial snack before training. That's enough from a coach. they're not a dietitian, and it's like, just stay in your lane. You can encourage positive nutrition habits without providing specific nutrition advice. And again, I think if a coach is concerned about those nutritional aspects, it's referring on to that dietitian. And so I'm going to segue from there. So we're mitigating risk. If we've identified an athlete that we are concerned of, what do we do? So this is where the coaches find it a little bit challenging, is because there is that initial potential conversation that you're going to have with an athlete. And it's not a brutal, I think you've got reds, you need to see someone. It's more just having a few little sort of safe questions. So do you feel like you're fueling appropriately for your training at the moment? How have you been feeling at training? I've just noticed you've not been completing the sets as you would usually. Is there something going on for you? And just some more exploratory questions with their athletes. And then there's also that referral. So potentially speaking with parents and carers about concerns, but it's then flagging who to go and see. So it's referring to a sports doctor who is across the red space. It's referring to a sports dietitian, again, familiar with reds. And they are out there now. You can find specialists with reds experience now. If a disordered eating disorder is identified, we then need the psych to be on board as well. And then what this actually does for the coach is they realise they've got a key role to play, but they've not got to fix the problem themselves. So they build their support network in terms of the sports doctor, the dietitian, the psych. And what you'll tend to find is once coaches find these people, that's their network, so that then when they've got problems, they can refer to those people that they know, and they stay connected. That's the really important part, is being across what's going on with their athlete. So if there are changes that they need to make to training, if the dietitian or the sports doctor says she needs to cut that by 50%, the coach knows what the information is that they need to take on board to amend their practice to make sure that the athlete's safe and on that pathway to recovery. It's a lot. There's a lot to take on. And I guess I've just tried to condense a workshop into a very brief summary there. But the information is coming out. And as I say, there's a lot of people, and myself and others, who are working to try and help our coaches. So, but there are resources now coming out online a lot more. And as we've spoke to the IOC consensus statement, I know not everyone is into reading journals, but it's a great place to try and kind of get your head across it.
From what you said, if the more the coach tries to police someone's relationship with food or their physical state, that's quite a danger zone to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our athletes are under huge amounts of pressure as it is in terms of physique and body image. We live in a society where kind of that's the glamorized thing, and athletes are in the spotlight even more because of things like social media and the expectation of them to maintain this kind of body ideal to be accepted as an athlete. And there's this almost this kind of fear from an athlete's perspective of, if I don't meet that body ideal, I won't be good enough to be an athlete. And so there's this huge amount of pressure that is already on them beyond their pressure that they experience to achieve performance success. A coach placing that pressure on an athlete is just not helpful. And I think what we also need to remember is, even for our physique-based sports, we get to a point where there will be a sweet spot for an athlete, and that sweet spot might be different for different athletes in terms of their physique. But once they hit that, if they continue to drop weight or manage their physique further, their performance actually declines. And so we really need to be so careful in this space, because a few words that can be said can be the trigger for an athlete to go down that very negative path towards an eating disorder. And I can't emphasize that enough. And so I really would say to coaches, if you're in doubt, just don't say it. If there is any doubt in your mind that something could be potentially triggering or harmful, just don't go there. And what we actually had from our athletes was they wanted so much more feedback in terms of performance language. So they wanted the language that was about what was happening in the water. So you're looking really strong as you're gliding through the water, or how streamlined they were looking. Real things that focused more on what their performance was doing, rather than you're looking super lean, you're going to swim well. Like, they didn't find that helpful at all, but they found that performance language really inspiring and really motivating. So I guess that's another thing I would say to coaches, is really try and embrace that performance language rather than that kind of appearance-based language.
There is a quote from some of the material you sent to me, so I'll just read it here. Let us cease the need to rescue athletes from the depths of struggles and instead focus our efforts upstream to prevent their descent in the first place.
Yeah, I absolutely love that quote. And it was actually the quote that I finished my PhD with. I think it resonates with me on many levels, but I think most importantly, because a lot of our research that has been done has focused on what REDS is, why it's a problem, what the consequences are, prevalence rates across different sports, how athletes are experiencing REDS, how we should treat athletes who are experiencing REDS. But what we really haven't done, and this was what I was just so determined to do in my PhD, was look at how can we actually go upstream and prevent our athletes from getting this condition in the first place. And so I guess that's why that quote really resonated, because we're saying let's not have to rescue them out of the river. Let's go upstream and prevent them falling in from the first place. And so I think the more we can really work in that preventative space, the less athletes we're going to have to see experience this issue, which is just, it's such a horrible condition in sport. For every athlete is on that positive trajectory who lives and breathes their sport, and it's their dream to be within that sport, who gets knocked down by a completely preventable condition, and it can just turn their path upside down. So I just empathize with them so much and just have so much that I want to do in terms of that preventative space. So thank you for calling on that quote, because, yeah, I think it really speaks into that, like, preventative space for REDS.
Yeah, I think today you've really brought the athlete and coach voices to the fore in our discussion. Is there finally anything else you wish to add?
Yeah, I just think I probably just want to shout out to all the athletes and coaches who might be listening to this podcast, that if you are concerned, don't hesitate. No matter, like, especially for our athletes, if you have any thoughts that you could potentially be showing any signs or symptoms of low energy availability or REDS, no matter how small it is, don't wait to get it checked out, because often this condition is silent for a long time. And I want this to be emphasized to the coaches as well. Many athletes will be experiencing REDS right now without anybody knowing. And often we only start to realize that somebody has REDS when they've had it for a long period of time, and then we've already developed some significant health issues, and often that can be to bone. So be alert. And I don't want anyone to feel scared. I think it's more being equipped with this kind of idea that I know what I'm looking out for. And if I'm spotting anything, I know I'm going to nip it in the bud early, because when we do that, it can be rectified so quickly. But if there are any concerns, it's like, get checked out straight away, seek that nutritional support from a registered sports dietitian, and just make sure that we're fueling for the work required, because yeah, every athlete deserves to reach their potential. And I think every athlete can when we can create these environments for them. So, yeah.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, for coming on the podcast today.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great.
That brings us to the end of this episode. Please check out the episode notes for further information.